Okay, so we are going to get to the last two chapters. This is Module 12 and Module 16. I won't be going too in-depth into these two chapters. These are going to be chapters that you're going to have to go through and kind of read to fill in the details on your own. They're not heavily covered in the state exam, so this is more so for your general knowledge and just so you can get a little bit more in-depth knowledge in regards to emotional, social needs, some cardiac respiratory functions, as well as the home health setting. So again, I'm just going to kind of brief and touch on the important topics, and then please go through and fill in your knowledge as needed. So we're going to start in part one, 106, and again, this module two is called Understanding Long-Term Care. The objective is to enhance each resident's quality of life. So these first two chapters, starting on 106, basically just talk about dealing with some difficult behavior. So again, remember, as a CNA, you are able to work with a vast, you know, variety of different age groups and in different settings. However, our focus is mainly on the geriatric population because that is mainly who we serve, especially in certain settings such as nursing homes and home health. So some of the content, you know, will highly focus in on that older population. So that being said, it explains how growing old affects people physically, psychologically, and socially. Aging brings physical and emotional changes, loss, and different roles. It is difficult for anyone to change from being independent to depending on others for care. So mainly what this is going to go in to explain is just giving you a little bit of background so that you can approach your geriatric population with some sympathy and understanding, right? So just realizing that the people that we are caring for are dealing with a bunch of different things that, you know, they're not all what meets the eye, right? So they may be dealing with the knowledge that, you know, they may be facing death themselves really soon. They may be dealing with the loss of, you know, a lot of friends or reminiscing on siblings or parents, as well as physically they're having so many different changes, right? They move slower than they used to. They're not as independent as they used to be. A lot of things are kind of weighing on them. And then, of course, they may have some kind of illness. So they may be dealing with heart problems, respiratory problems, depending on some kind of machine or oxygen, just things that overall can affect the psyche of a human being. So whenever you are dealing with patients, especially with your geriatric patients, just being sensitive to the fact that, again, no one really plans to end up in a position where they are dependent on someone else. And it's just the circle of life that, you know, with age, you become a little bit more dependent. So just being sensitive to that, having sympathy, and again, always remembering that it's really a blessing to be able to serve people kind of at their weakest and at their lowest and at their most vulnerable. So going forward, it talks a little bit about managing behavior on 106. Mainly, it's the same thing we kind of touched on other subjects. Mainly, the way to deal with difficult behavior or to get, you know, people to be a little more cooperative, mainly it's going to be to listen to what people are saying, showing interest, showing respect, and offering, you know, smiles and acknowledgments and giving acknowledging accomplishments. Mainly, you have to show the attitude that you're wanting to receive, right? So if you're coming in and you're standoffish and you're removed, there's, you know, a slim chance that the warmth and openness that you're looking for, you're needing to be able to facilitate your care is going to be mirrored back to you, right? So if you're wanting someone to open up and knowing that this takes time, right? And that's the beauty of some of these settings, especially with nursing homes and home health care, is you are getting to be with patients for long periods of time. So you have time to build rapport and to build that trust. And just consistently coming into that atmosphere with an openness, with an understanding, with patience, that will take you a long way, especially in regards to dealing with some more quote-unquote difficult behavior. But as we understand, it's behavior that is a symptom of something bigger and deeper that we may not be able to see at all times. So we're going to go over to page 107. We're going to kind of skim through 107 and 108 and 109. They are basically they're basically going through the body system and the anatomy and physiology, which is great for your knowledge. I am not going to go through and read through all of these body systems. We've talked about the important body systems through other chapters in regards to the ones that, you know, you're going to be heavily caring for, such as integumentary, which is skin, respiratory, urinary, GI, digestive. You know, we've kind of touched on a lot of these body systems. This is just the avenue for you to go through and read through the anatomy and physiology. So anatomy is going to be the structure of it, like how, what it is, right? So for integumentary, the anatomy is your skin, hair and nails, and then physiology is what it does, right? So the physiology of the integumentary system is that it controls temperature, keeps germs out. And as we have talked about in previous chapters, when we talked about skin breakdown, we have talked about the importance of keeping the skin, you know, intact and dry and all of that good stuff so that it can continue to keep germs out so that we don't get infections. So you can kind of read through this and tie this to earlier chapters and when we discuss certain body systems and why we care for it the way that we do. So that being said, we're going to skip on over to 110, part four, dealing with confusion. So this is going to test on dementia and Alzheimer's specifically and general confusion. So I just want to be really, really clear because, again, you can work in different settings. There is kind of chronic long-term confusion that is consistent with what the patient is presenting with. And then there is sudden abrupt confusion, like out of nowhere. Those are two different things and they need to be treated two different ways, right? If you're dealing with a patient with dementia or Alzheimer's, and you come in and they're not sure of their name, they're not sure what day it is, they can't remember you, they are not aware of where they're at, but that's consistent with their diagnosis, they have known dementia, then that is one thing, right? And then we're just caring for them according to the plan of care. If you're coming into a patient's room and the day before you were having a full conversation with them, they don't have any diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's, they're just, you know, they're an older person, maybe they're a little bit forgetful, but in general, their mind is intact. Like I said, you were speaking with them like normal the day before. They were talking, interacting with you. They knew all the orientation questions, their name, you know, situation, app, location, things like that. And then you come in maybe within that same shift, the end of your shift or in a new shift, and now this patient is completely confused. Dementia doesn't necessarily develop overnight, right? So that can be an indication of something else. So that's why later on in this chapter, we'll talk about things like strokes, because sudden onset confusion is usually an emergency, right? That means something's going on. You could have really low blood sugar that can lead to confusion. You could have a stroke that's leading to some sort of confusion, or maybe the electrolytes are out of balance, right? Sometimes when people's sodium is too low or too high. All of that being said, there could be something more acute or more life-threatening going on if the confusion is just out of nowhere and there's no history of that patient being confused. But we're going to start with the expected confusion, which would be dementia and Alzheimer's. So on 110, it explains that dementia is a disorder that impairs a person's mental ability. There are many types of dementia and many causes of confused behavior. Some are reversible and some are considered irreversible. Dementia is a symptom of brain malfunctioning. So mainly with dementia, like I said, it's a symptom of the brain malfunctioning. Usually the effects on a person with dementia is the inability to think very clearly. Sometimes personality changes and their judgment is a bit impaired. And again, it's kind of a spectrum, so it looks different on everyone. Some people it's a little more advanced, some people it's a little more manageable. And like they said, for the most part, some forms of it may be reversible, most parts of it is irreversible. And then it goes through to kind of explain a few conditions that look like dementia. So a drug reaction, nutritional deficiencies, brain tumors, depression, head injuries, thyroid problems, right? So again, this is why we always want to make sure we're looking at the history of the patient so that we know that nothing else is going on, right? So a drug reaction, if we aren't paying close enough attention, a patient could be confused because they're reacting to a new drug they just started, right? So this is why we really want to pay attention to what is the patient's normal, comparing what they were, you know, before and what they are after. so that we can differentiate between, you know, a chronic brain dysfunction and some kind of acute process. Dementia is usually considered irreversible when it's caused by Alzheimer's disease, stroke, or other diseases that affect the nervous system, cardiovascular system, or pulmonary system. And again, we'll talk about Alzheimer's in just a little bit. Here on page 110, it touches on reality orientation. This is going to be very, very important. There are certain things you can do for your patient to consistently try to bring them back to reality or help for them, help them not to get even more confused, right? So there's certain things that kind of affect the human mind. If you think about being in the hospital, if you're in a hospital room and there are no windows open, after a certain amount of time, patients start to kind of lose track of morning and daytime, and that can cause what we call delirium, and that can happen to absolutely anybody. That's not about age. So we already know in the healthcare setting that there are certain things that help to regulate the brain, and certain things, certain familiar objects or familiar items, or certain routines that can kind of help the brain kind of stay in a routine and stay in touch with reality. It's not going to reverse the dementia, but it definitely can help some of the symptoms. So some of the reality orientation include making sure that you identify yourself each time you come into the room, repeat the person's name often, speak slowly and calmly and use simple words that the resident understands, open the drapes during the day and close them at night. It's very important. Making sure that you're exposing the patient to light during the day so that their body can stay consistent with night and day is very, very important with orientation. Encourage the resident to watch TV and listen to the radio. Protect the resident from injury. He or she may not be aware of hazards. Avoid rearranging furniture. Ask simple questions and allow time for response. Make sure you repeat the day, date, and time often and put calendars and clocks where the residents can easily see them. And then also discuss familiar people, objects, and events. Try not to rush the residents. Encourage socialization. Make sure you do not isolate patients. And be patient and be kind. So these are just a few things that can just kind of help on a daily basis keep a patient more regular and keep them kind of more in tune with their surroundings and what's going on. And the socialization portion is very, very important. You want to make sure that patients are interacting and mixing and mingling with their cohort or other people in their facility. Isolation, time alone, is definitely going to work against the brain. Darkness, being left alone, not being tended to, is definitely going to degenerate the brain even faster. It also talks about some validation music and reminiscence, basically music therapy, and how that can help the patient with memory and staying in touch. Now, Alzheimer's disease, and we're on page 111 now, Alzheimer's disease is a brain disorder with no known cause or cure at this time. It is the most common form of irreversible dementia. More than 5 million people in the United States are victims of Alzheimer's disease, and the number is expected to triple in the next 50 years. So as you can see, Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia, but it's a little more specific. It has different phases, as well as this, it's considered irreversible, right? So we're just going to talk about the different phases. Phase one is mild, which is when there's subtle changes and some brief episodes of confusion, but it's intertwined with normal behavior, right? So it's kind of mild. Sometimes they're coherent. Sometimes they seem a little bit more coherent, less coherent than other times. The reaction times become a little bit more slow, and their judgment is still a little bit impaired. But like I said, it's still intertwined with moments of or episodes of being coherent, right? And then you move over to phase two, which is moderate. And this is when it becomes a little more apparent that there is confusion there. So this is where the resident functions, but is increasingly forgetful and confused. He or she needs supervision and may need help with activities of daily living, such as bathing, toileting, and dressing. There may be mood swings and unusual behaviors. The residents becomes increasingly disoriented and cannot remember people and places. It becomes more difficult to speak or understand language, and the attention span becomes even shorter. And then the last one is going to be phase three, which is going to be very, very severe. This is when the resident becomes totally dependent and needs constant supervision. The resident has difficulty communicating or using good judgment and does not recognize loved ones. The person may lose the most basic abilities, including the ability to walk, speak, swallow, and control bowel and bladder. So this is going to be your most severe stage. It's going to be when the patient is probably heavily dependent on the care of caregivers, not able to complete activities of daily living, not able to really take care of themselves, not oriented enough to just carry out just basic living functions. That's going to be the most severe form of Alzheimer's disease. And again, remembering that till this day, they have not identified a cure. It's extremely difficult to deal with, especially from a family perspective. But again, we just do our best to be patient, to be kind, to listen, to follow the care plan, and just support them at whatever level of support they need. Then it goes to the next page, 112, to talk about cognitive impairment, which cognition is the mental process of learning and acquiring knowledge. People who are cognitively impaired are limited in what they can learn and remember. Some can learn self-care with assistance, and some are totally dependent on others for their care. So cognitive impairment, this is can span through the different ages, right? So when we're thinking of cognitive impairment, we're not really visualizing any age. There are children that are born with cognitive impairment. You can see teenagers, young adults that have cognitive impairment. This is just more so based on how a person's brain functions and how they grasp information. And again, this can be determined by birth. So this isn't isolated to just the geriatric population. So knowing that in general, main things we want to keep in mind with this is to use verbal cues, learn the resident's name, treat residents who are cognitively impaired the same as you would treat other residents, making sure that you're not being belittling, again, being respectful, being patient. So then it goes to 112, to part five, where we talk about understanding chronic respiratory disease. Again, you can read through this. It's mainly just talking about some common respiratory diseases you'll interact with, just dealing with older patients or sick patients, which is things like COPD, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, sometimes pneumonia. Main thing you need to know is at some point this will alter the pulmonary system, and it's a little more chronic versus acute, which means it's going to have chronic changes and effects on the lungs, which just means that they just may need certain accommodations, right? It may mean a person with COPD may easily run out of breath. They may need to take a little more time in activities with getting up, with ambulation. They could be on oxygen, things like that. So they might need some kind of respiratory support. They may be on long-term respiratory medications to kind of help with whatever function is diminished. We're going to go over to page 113, part six, talking about coping with cancer. So again, cancer is something that is not isolated to any specific age. You can deal with pediatric patients with cancer. You can deal with older patients with cancer. Mainly just being kind of aware of some of the side effects that patients who are, you know, experiencing cancer specifically or dealing with some kind of chemotherapy or radiation or surgery, some things to kind of be mindful of. So we know cancer is basically a malignant tumor, right? So it's abnormal growth of cell, and that can be on any cell, right? So you can have an abnormal growth of cell in the lungs, on the skin, in the intestines, right? It could be in any place, but basically it's a cell growing rapidly and kind of taking over the body system. And there's a plethora of things that can contribute to cancer, smoking and radiation, alcohol, certain viruses. Some warning signs that we can be alert to in the healthcare setting. Changes in bowel and bladder habits. So, you know, if you have like a 30, 40-year-old who was previously continent, able to use the bathroom, all of a sudden they're losing bowel function. Maybe on top of that, they're having rectal bleeding. This could be a sign of, you know, something going wrong in that system. It could be an abnormal growth. And again, this is why it's always so important to document what you're seeing and to report any changes or anything abnormal that we're seeing with patients, because it can be an indication of a bigger problem. So I talked about the three common treatments for cancer, which is surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy. The main side effects that you're going to deal with all of these therapies usually have to do with kind of appetite, nausea, vomiting, overall fatigue, changes to the skin, as well as dry mouth. And then, you know, very standard, we see this a lot. Hair loss happens a lot when people are undergoing some cancer treatments. So really just reading through the care plan and finding how best to support them and also maintain dignity in the dying process. Because a lot of times, a lot of these cancers are terminal. So that's going to be very, very important with caring for patients with cancer. Going over to page 114, this is part 7, caring for people with diabetes. So we just want to be aware with the signs and symptoms of high blood sugar and low blood sugar, and basically how our role in caring for the patient with diabetes. So as a nurse aide, you will be responsible in most facilities for taking blood sugar. Your goal is to obtain the blood sugar and then just communicate the results to the nurse. You are not necessarily acting on it, acting on the results. You may be given instructions in regards to maybe giving juice if the sugar is very low. But again, as after you complete that action item, you're immediately reporting back to your nurse, right? You're not managing it on your own. So diabetes is basically when there's a dysregulation in the body in regards to sugar and insulin. Some people are born with a lack of insulin. That's type 1 diabetics. So you could see that at any age, right? Usually you see that in younger children. You have type 2 diabetes, which is the diabetes that we're more used to. This is when over time, due to usually eating habits or, you know, a terrible diet, the pancreas is not able to regulate insulin and sugar the way that it used to, right? So that means whenever a patient eats, there is an excess amount of sugar flowing in the bloodstream because the pancreas cannot send it to the appropriate places because over time it has just been weakened, right? Mainly we want to know what high blood sugar and low blood sugar looks like because people with diabetes are at risk for both. So high blood sugar is life-threatening, yet, but it tends to take more time to develop, right? Low blood sugar is going to be a little, you can deal with low blood sugar on a daily basis. Getting to very dangerous levels of high blood sugar usually accumulates over time, over days or weeks, right? But high blood sugar is going to be when there's too little insulin or too much sugar, and the onset is gradual, like I explained. And usually the signs of high blood sugar, which is also called hyperglycemia, include excessive thirst, dry mouth, increased urination, drowsiness, headache, nausea, and abdominal pain. Some later signs, when it's actually like an actual emergency, you're going to see some rapid, heavy breathing, which we call Kuzma breathing. The breath is going to have a fruity scent, loss of consciousness, dry skin, flushed face, and ultimately death if it's not cared for in a reasonable time frame. But in the most part, people should be able to get help with high blood sugar before it becomes deadly. Low blood sugar is going to be the more life-threatening one. So low blood sugar is hypoglycemia. This is a condition resulting from too much insulin or too little sugar. And then a danger, there's danger of insulin shock when too much insulin has been given or too little food is consumed. And mainly how we're going to identify this is on the next page. Headache, dizziness, weakness, feeling faint, nervousness, anxiety, sudden hunger or craving for sweets, mood swings, irritability, or confusion. Confusion is going to be a big one, right? So a lot of times if I come in and I see a patient that was previously, you know, more alert and active, I come in the room, they're looking, you know, very tired, not having a lot of energy, not answering questions quickly, and I know they're a diabetic, that is going to be instantly we need to check their blood sugar, right? That's usually some indication that their sugar is low, and we can usually correct that relatively quickly, but the quicker you correct it, the easier it is. So if a patient is still relatively alert, I may tell the nurse aide, hey, let's grab some juice for them or some peanut butter crackers. They can drink that. We recheck it in 15 minutes, make sure it's gone up. But if they're getting to a point where the sugar is dropping so low that they're not able to wake up, then we may be doing a muscular injection or giving IV sugar to bring them back to life. And ultimately, if it's not corrected in time, it can lead to death because the brain survives on sugar. So if there's no sugar going up to the brain can ultimately shut down, right? Which is what we don't want. So always be very, very mindful. Keep an extra eye on your diabetic patients for any changes for them because we know that with diabetes, the sugar can be too high or too low. So we never want to take it for granted any sudden changes, any complaints of dizziness, any confusion, any changes in mentation. We never want to take that for granted with the patient with diabetes. Going to part 8 on 115, caring for heart disease. So this is similar to kind of the pulmonary section. Again, some chronic heart diseases that you may come in contact with, maybe CHF, which is chronic congestive heart failure, amongst other things. One that is relatively important is going to be a myocardial infarction, which is a very fancy medical word for a heart attack, right? Which is something we talked about in regards to the CPR lecture. Main takeaway from this is we want to really be sensitive to any heart complaints coming from patients. We don't want to take it for granted that, oh, they always complain about it. We always want to treat it as if it's a fresh complaint and address it accordingly, because you never know which time could lead to death, and you never want to be the one responsible for not responding appropriately to someone's complaint. So the main thing is going to be chest pain, right? Anyone complaining of chest pain, anyone getting short of breath, anyone feeling a panic, or my professor used to call it the feeling of impending doom, feeling like they're going to die, they feel a heaviness in their chest. Yes, some of these things may be anxiety, it may be psychologically related, but it is not your job to rule that out. It's not your job to determine that, right? We have to go through the due diligence to make sure that a heart attack isn't present. And again, it only takes one heart attack to kill someone, so we want to be sensitive to any heart complaints every single time, right? We would rather go through all of the works and find out it's not a heart attack than to assume that it's not and have a patient die, right? So that's going to be the main thing. So again, always, whenever you're checking a patient's pulse rate, if it's feeling weird, if it's really weak, you're checking blood pressure and it's low, a patient is lightheaded, short of breath, chest pain, those are all things that we want to immediately relate to our nurse. Going over to page 116, part 9, responding to seizure disorders. So the main thing, it talks about kind of the different types of seizure disorders. So generalized versus complex, partial, tonic-clonic. Don't really need to get into the details of that, but feel free to read through. Mainly, different seizures look different. Some may be when the patient is going to tense up and fall down. Some they lose their tone and fall down. Some they just stay there and convulse, which is a shaking of the muscles. Really what's important is knowing what to do when a patient is having a seizure. So the main thing is we want to protect the airway during the seizure. And protect them from injury. So the main thing is we want to make sure that we're never prying the patient's mouth open, and there should never, ever be anything put in the patient's mouth when they're actively convulsing. There are a huge risk for choking. So we want to make sure that a patient is laying down if they haven't already, if they're not already laying down or they didn't fall to the ground. We want to make sure that we help them down to a bed or lie them down. We want to put a pillow under their head. If it's possible, you want to turn their head to one side. It helps with them not choking. And if the seizure occurs on the floor, move furniture and equipment out of the way. If the person is in the bed, pad the side rails with blankets or soft foam. So the goal is while they're convulsing, they're not going to hit anything or hurt themselves or damage their head, and nothing's going to go in their mouth, and they're not going to choke, right? That's the main thing we're trying to avoid. So those are going to be your main precautions. And usually you want to stay with the seizure patient. So if for some reason you're with a patient and they start to have a seizure, but you need help in the room, which you will need help in the room, you're going to maybe press your staff alert button or yell out for help, but try to stay with your patient. And that goes for all of these things, right? If a patient is all of a sudden confused or has chest pain or has anything abnormal about them, we don't want to walk out and leave the patient, right? We want to call for help, and that's why we usually have some kind of button in the room of these facilities that can alert people to come meet you in the room and help you out so that you don't have to leave the patient to get help. So make sure that we're never really leaving a patient alone whenever they're in some kind of acute state. Page 117, last page here, part 10, understanding strokes. So the main thing, we just want to be aware of the signs and symptoms of a stroke so that we can know what to do immediately, right? Because when it comes to strokes and heart attacks, time is money, right? Every second a brain cell is dying, every second a heart cell is dying. So we do not want to waste time. We want to be able to identify it and act quick. Main thing that you're going to see with stroke is a patient can be complaining of numbness or tingling. Mainly you're going to see a weakness on one side of the face or one side of the body. They call it facial drooping. And you'll notice one side of the face will not be responding like the other side will be, right? So maybe the smile is drooping on one side, or the patient's not able to move one side of their body. That is a huge, huge, huge red flag for a stroke. Confusion, new onset confusion, is going to be a problem. Any impaired vision for one or both eyes, dizziness, or severe headache. Those are going to be usually your main signs of a stroke. Again, this is why we never take confusion for granted, because it could be the sign of the brain dying by the second, right? If you notice any of those things, that is an emergency, right? In hospitals, you'll hear it called as a code stroke. It is an emergency. You are immediately calling for a nurse. You're immediately calling for help, because the goal is, in the case that a person is having a stroke, you want to get them to imaging and to any intervention within an hour or so, because after 3 to 4 hours, some people can go brain dead, right? So those are going to be the main signs of a stroke. And then again, dealing with patients with strokes, a lot of time the brain is separated into two different hemispheres, and one side controls one side. So the right side of the brain usually controls the left side of the body. Left side of the brain usually controls the right side of the body. So a lot of times, depending on where the infarction or the brain bleed is in the brain, that's going to determine which side of the body is affected. So a lot of times you'll see one-sided weakness or one-sided loss of function goes hand in hand with a stroke, because it means one side of the brain was affected by the stroke, and you'll be able to tell which side based on which part of the body is affected. But with strokes, some people are able to make recovery or able to recover some functions, even if they don't go back to a complete baseline. But again, the sooner there's intervention, the better their recovery, or the better chance they have for recovery. So that concludes module 12. Going over to page 118, you have a review here. So make sure that you're going through and reading through, understanding what things like COPD is. CVA is another word for a stroke, a cerebral vascular accident is a technical medical term for a stroke. But going through and making sure you can identify these highlights and work through these 8 review questions. And we're going to move over to module 16 and wrap it up. So module 16 is going to start on page 135. Mainly this is going to talk about home health care. So basically, most of the care that we are giving in, you know, the nursing home setting and the assisted living setting can be and will be given in the home setting, right? So module 16 is called Introducing Home Healthcare. Objective includes to help the client stay as healthy and self-managing as possible, right? So in the ideal situation for a lot of patients, if they're able to receive all of the care that we provide in a nursing home or assisted living, if they're able to receive that in their home, especially with their family, that's going to be ideal. That's not possible for everyone, but for the people that it is possible for, we just want to make sure that we are providing the same level and type of care for them that we would in any other setting, right? And here it identifies the HHA, which is a home health aide, and know that the home health aide may not do all the same things as a certified nurse aide, but a certified nurse aide can do all the same things and more than a home health aide. So, and usually a CNA will be the one working in a home health setting. It's just as a CNA, you can also work in other settings. Just kind of skimming through, and again, feel free to read through in more in depth in your own time. But mainly, you just want to make sure that we're going to skip over to page 138. We want to make sure that we're creating the same safe and sanitary environment that we would in any other setting, right? So all the things that, all the rules and regulations, especially in regards to activities of daily living that we've talked about through other chapters, they still apply in the home health setting, right? It may look a little bit different, but they still apply there. So we're still washing our hands before and after contact with our patients. We're still washing our hands before and after eating or providing food for them or using the bathroom or handling garbage or sneezing or coughing. We're still disposing of linens in similar manners. It may be a difference between put it in the laundry basket versus, you know, the soiled linens. You may be responsible for helping the patient with doing laundry, but nevertheless, we're still handling all of the things with care. If we're providing bed baths, we're still following the same techniques. if we're helping to ambulate to the shower, ambulate to the bath, still the same techniques, still the same safety measures, right? Going over to page 139, cleaning and home safety is going to be very important. The main thing about being in the home health setting is you are the patient's lifeline, right? So you're going to be the one to see if something is wrong in the house, if there's a safety hazard, if there's handrails on the stairways that are going bad or are loose, or if there's some kind of hazard in the house, you're the one who's identifying it. So you want to be super mindful and always make sure that you're communicating to your supervisor if any, you know, problems or safety hazards in the household, so that, you know, they can be acted upon adequately. And as well as cleaning, you shouldn't be, you know, for the most part, doing a full in-depth cleaning spree of your client's home, but you will be responsible for, you know, maintaining a certain level and standard, especially in regards to the care that you provide, and just remembering that you're there because the patient needs help, right? So leaving a patient in filth or dirt, knowing that they are not, that they're dependent on you, is, you know, it's bad care, right? Because you're affecting the patient's quality of life. So doing the best that you can to help with keeping the home, you know, safe and cleanly, especially keeping it clutter-free and getting hazards out of the way so that we're not putting patients at risk for fall. And then on page 140, it talks about kitchen safety, food handling, food storage. So a lot of times you'll be there to bring out meals for the patient. So making sure that the food is stored safely, handling the food correctly, making sure you're wearing gloves when handling food, as well as making sure temperatures are appropriate, things like that. We're going to go over to page 141. And again, it talks about physical health. All of these things are things that we've discussed in previous chapters. So in regards to circulation, dressing and undressing, a patient's balance, vision and hearing, self-care, they all are going to be the same measurements in care that we've been talking about. These are just, we're going to be providing our care now in the home health setting. In regards to medications, so always remember that you're not dispensing medications. All you can do is provide reminders. You can set it in front of a patient if it's already been pulled out. And if the patient refuses to take medication or takes more than the prescribed amount, you have to report that immediately. And again, we're always looking for side effects, so being mindful of certain side effects, such as diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, rashes, etc. But the home health aide is never dispensing medications. Then we go to the next page. It talks about oxygen. Again, you cannot administer oxygen, but we could be mindful of how the tubing is affecting the skin, and just things like that. If the patient is complaining of shortness of breath and they're on oxygen, maybe the oxygen is not on properly or not at the correct amount, so we can communicate that to supervisors so that that can be changed. And then when it comes to mental health, this is going to be the same measurements as we've talked about in previous chapters. And again, regardless of the setting, we're always wanting to be patient and understanding. We always want to give patients time to maneuver through activities of daily living, and give the appropriate accommodations, as well as following the care plan. You will still have a care plan even in the home health setting. Going to page 143, this is where it talks about the family, and it kind of talks about different stages of development. Going through, it's really important to understand what age different things are being highlighted. Mainly, you'll see here for the older years, 65 years and above, this is when you start people start focusing on their ego and integrity, and kind of focusing on, you know, their purpose and what they've accomplished here in life. Whereas in the first year of life. So that's an important one to kind of read through and understand at different ages what the brain is focusing on and how the different personalities are being developed. And these are called the Erickson's 8 stages of life. Going over to page 144, we're going to speak more so on finding resources. So mainly we want our patients to have, you know, a robust quality of life at all stages of life. So any way that we can contribute to that, social and recreational activities are going to be great ways to break up the monotony of especially elder life. A lot of times these patients are in the same routine, kind of doing the same things every day. So, you know, anything, if it's music therapy or, you know, respite care or going outside for walks, kind of anything to break up that monotonous routine, it definitely helps quality of life. And that's, you know, something that we can understand. Having to do the same thing the same way every single day can get a bit boring, right? So we want to make sure that we're helping to engage the patient and community resources as often as possible. And going over to page 145, community resources are available for the elderly. Found out what services are available in your community. And it goes through the list kind of some things like YMCA, hospice, food banks, Meals on Wheels, just different things that cater to our population. And summary here, the goal of home care is to keep clients as healthy and independent as possible in the comfort of their homes. The home health aide needs to be sensitive and flexible to the needs of the client and the family. The home health aide is a part of a care team and works under the supervision of a licensed nurse. The same high standards apply to home health aides and nurse aides, including infection control, clean surroundings, safety, upholding client rights, and tending to special needs. And again, go to page 146, do your review, go through those 8 questions, and that should conclude Module 12 and Module 16. And again, if there's anything you want to fill in your knowledge about, go through and kind of read the chapters in a little bit more in depth. But that concludes these 2 chapters.